Well, Lord Chairman, thank you very much for introducing me and the subject. I was going to explain for those few here that aren't members of the House of Lords that the way the system works is, and I think very well, is that the House decides each parliamentary session that it should have, I think it is four, so-called ad hoc committees which look at items that are of a special interest at that time, and the House reports back within that parliamentary year, and then the committee dissolves. The question is, what do we do from there? The answer is that clearly the members and indeed Parliament follow that up. But the Arctic was one that was chosen just over a year ago. It was chosen because the Arctic has an international flavour, and the House is very keen to get involved in a number of international issues and themes. But most importantly, because the Arctic, as all of you will know, is a part of the globe where change is happening most, especially in climate change and all the repercussions of that. And although the committee took a lot of evidence around climate change, the one thing we knew that we mustn't do was to get into discussing what the causes of climate change are. Because if we started doing that, the Arctic would recede into the distance even more than it is naturally at the moment, and we would no doubt spend a lot of time going through all of that, as we have some very strong proponents on either side of that particular argument. But it is because of the change of climate in the Arctic, amplified in terms of in comparison with the rest of the globe, that is the reason that this study was so important. And we felt it was particularly important for the British Parliament, the House of Lords in particular, to take up this issue because, as all of you that have ever looked at a globe are aware, the United Kingdom is the Arctic's nearest state, or nearest non-Arctic state, that there is. There are eight Arctic states of the in the Arctic Council. We are, well, I should say, in the Shetland, I think it's called Outstack. I've not been there personally, but is a mere 320 miles away from the Arctic Circle. So we have some real interest there. Let me just go through some of the very broad climatic and climate change environment in terms of what we discovered and what we discussed. Certainly, there is big changes there. The amount of sea ice has decreased over the last, almost halved since over the last couple of decades. And of course, although the area might have halved, and that has on all sorts of effects in terms of reflecting the sun's energy back into space or not, even more importantly perhaps, the volume of sea ice has gone down by some 75%, because when it refreezes, you only have the thickness of 1 year. So it's a big change. However, as we all know, that doesn't affect sea level as such. That only gets really serious when the Greenland ice shelf starts to disappear. And should that disappear altogether, then it would mean that we would certainly be meeting in our scuba outfits, even if not more here this evening, in that that's a change of some 7 metres or some 23 foot of water, which puts in perspective the whole climate change area. The committee went to Svalbard, and Spitsbergen on Svalbard, which is a mere 800 miles from the North Pole, but very much in the Gulf Stream, as I used to know it from my geography days, and is largely ice-free these days because of some of those changes, certainly on its western seaboard. And we went out there and we met, has a population of a mere 2,000, but has an excellent university facility there, and we went out and we discussed a number of issues with students and staff there, and we were amused to see come across a cupboard which was alongside all the warm clothing, which was labelled welfare rifles, believe it or not. And that, for those of you that know the region, is an essential bit of kit, because when we went out of the town there, then we had to be accompanied by someone who was armed because of the wildlife. I couldn't quite work out, in fact, because the legislation is that polar bears are utterly protected, what we were actually supposed to do, to surrender or actually to take evasive or more violent action. But there we are. Let me move on to some of the areas that we looked at. The good news is that the Arctic is probably one of the best governed regions of the world in many ways, or international areas. We have the 8 Arctic states and the Arctic Council, founded in 1996, and it has grown in stature. It didn't have a secretariat when it started, does now. It has a chairmanship that rotates every 2 years. When the committee met, it was chaired by Canada, now the United States, and it has started to bring together and to not legislation as such, but have enforceable agreements. Two of those, one of them being around oil spills, the other one being around search and rescue. And why that's particularly important these days is not just because of economic development, but because of tourism. And when we arrived in Svalbard and we thought we were at the edge of humanity, really starting to push the frontiers, certainly of the House of Lords, forward, we reached the place where we were staying, and there must have been some 200 German tourists there that would have made the average age of the House of Lords look young. So there is a real growth in people that are there. But if things go wrong, then they have to be rescued, and this area is very, very remote indeed. So that's one of the areas that is starting to be looked at. There is now a Coast Guard agreement, but something that needs particular care and attention. So the Arctic states are there. They have a number of observers states. Britain was one of the first of those. But in 2013, they expanded the number of observers quite substantially. And it's particularly important who those observers were. They are India, China, South Korea, Singapore, and there's Italy as well, and Poland, but also Japan. So there is that great interest now in the Arctic from the fast-growing and large Asian economies. Why is that? Well, Singapore, clearly it's around freight and transport routes. But generally, there is that draw of resources. But what came absolutely clear, though, is that the Arctic is a very, very remote place and very different. It's not homogenous. It's unlike the Arctic. It has no landmass, of course. It is a sea that is enclosed. And it has the high seas that are beyond the remit of economic zones. So there's a lot of challenges there. In terms of security, then we didn't look greatly at that, but clearly one of the two important events that happened while we were taking evidence, one of them was the Russian annexation of Crimea and the conflict in East Ukraine, and the other was the huge decrease in oil prices for mineral extractors and oil companies. And they had had very major effects, and come on to some of the conclusions that the committee made. On the international relations side, although the Arctic Council doesn't deal with military matters, then clearly it survives by strong cooperation in science, and in all the civil areas of whether it's shipping and all the other and research and all the other sort of areas, it's very important that those 8 Arctic states are able to continue business as normal. And so one of the important recommendations that we put forward to the international community, if you like, is that those international problems, there needs to be a certain degree of isolation. The Canadian government, now changed, was quite aggressive relatively to Russia, and a number of meetings didn't start to happen. And there's been some other scientific ones as well where I think there's been problems. But generally, the cooperation in the Arctic has managed to continue, and we welcome that very much indeed. Just one other thing around the Arctic Council. It has a group, as well as nation states, it also has special representatives of indigenous people. The Arctic has some 4 million inhabitants altogether. That's not a great, most of them are in Russia, but 500,000 of those are indigenous peoples, whether it's First Nation in Canada, Sami in Scandinavia, Inuit, obviously, and the various Native American tribes as well. And it's with the growth of observers, we have a great concern that their voice is being squeezed out more than it was in the past. And yet it's clearly important culturally, but also from information and living there and knowledge, that those communities are not only able to survive, but able to thrive and to be a part, a big determinants of development, as well as part, being a part of development. But what is clear, the so-called scramble for the Arctic is not going to happen in that sort of way. The number of transits of vessels across the Northern Passage through Russia is still very small. You still need it to effectively be icebreakers. Most of that traffic is to settlements that are already there. They're not transits from one ocean to another. So although that route cuts off a great number of nautical miles from the Pacific down to other areas, then that is not going to be a big area of development in the short term. And indeed, even in terms of mineral extraction, and we've seen this year how Shell have moved back out of the Arctic region, then that development will be really quite slow. And so one of the key recommendations that we saw in terms of the way that the Arctic does develop, because it will do, and those climatic changes are going to happen, is that we have some time to make the rules and to find the right way to handle that development while oil prices are low and while the sea ice, unfortunately, inevitably retreats, even if erratically, as time goes on. And the international community, the Arctic Council, need to follow on that very strongly. But the area that I think astonished us most, I see Lord Julian Hunt, I think, is somewhere here. He will not, at the back there, he was not surprised by any of it, but other committee members were, is really the huge gap in knowledge that we have about this region, whether it goes in terms of mapping and hydrographic information through, obviously, to ecosystems and scientific information as well. And although the Arctic Council and its various parts do a lot of cooperative science work, then there is a huge amount more still to do. And I was very pleased that when we recommended that the UK should get its act together more in this area, it's clearly there and has been participating for some time, then this should be coordinated better and we should work more closely with other observer states and Arctic members to make sure that we really did increase our capacity and knowledge of the region. Fisheries, there is unfortunately a high seas area in the middle of the Arctic, obviously, and in one other area as well, not covered by EEZs. And there we feel great caution should be shown in terms of the fisheries industry, and that there should be a moratorium there. Discussions are starting and are continuing in that area while we understand the ecosystems much better. And we very much welcome the progress that has been made in that area. In the UK's sense, obviously, we have a great interest in the Antarctic for strategic reasons and for the fact that we have land claims there in terms of Antarctica, which are on ice, literally, while the Antarctic Treaty is in force, but also, obviously, our interests in the South Atlantic. So we felt that that balance between the north and the south, where we have excellent scientific work and knowledge in Antarctica, they are very different areas of the globe, obviously, but we needed to get a better balance with the north. The whole balance of the environment and the environment was one that the committee clearly were highly exercised about. And although there was not going to be this scramble for resources that we saw, it is extremely expensive to set up mining there. One of the examples that we had from when I was in the Yukon in Canada was that I think just sending one flight of staff every 2 weeks out to a mine and then sending the current ship, the two-week ship, back, just one of those plane journeys cost something like 100,000, I think it was American dollars, to do that. And that just shows, again, the remoteness and the expense of doing that. And, of course, the one area where research is needed more and where change is taking place is one of permafrost. And we need to understand very much, much better the methane and the carbon results of permafrost and also methane from the seabed in the Arctic, as well as conditions change. But also, of course, with so much development in remote areas depending on ice roads, permafrost and climate change actually works against on-land development rather than for it. And so you have these sort of problems as well. We very much welcomed the International Maritime Organization, based in London, of course, with its new polar code, although even in there, in areas like heavy fuel oil and black carbon, we think there's areas where that needs to improve. But, Chairman, in terms of the United Kingdom, what we felt most was that although Britain is the nearest neighbour, although Britain has a long history of interest in the Arctic, in science and in exploration, then, if you like, we had lost a little bit of focus when the rest of the world was particularly starting to pile in. And so what we did recommend, one of our major recommendations, was that the United Kingdom should appoint, as a number of other countries have, its own Arctic ambassador. And as I reminded the House last night, that does not mean someone sitting on a desk at the North Pole with a satellite phone reporting into the Foreign Office saying what's going on there. It's rather more subtle than that, but it is probably someone with a scientific background, with some diplomacy, hopefully, as well, that is able to bring together all the various strands of policy that we have in the UK, and industrial and environmental and NGO interest as well, so we have a proper and a real top-level focus in terms of our Arctic policy. I regret that the government decided, although it hasn't closed the door, not to implement that particular recommendation, but I hope it is something that they will consider for the future. France, Japan, Poland, Singapore already have that. So if I can conclude as I come to the end of my time, the UK at the moment has what's called a framework strategy, which Jane, I'm sure, will talk about, or a framework for Arctic policy. We felt this was we liked the policy generally, but we felt rather than a framework, this was too defensive, that Britain should show rather more leadership while showing complete respect for the Arctic nations that there are, and that we should make sure that we are one of the leading observer nations, making sure that this part of the world, where what affects it affects us very directly, we are an important part of. And I think I was very pleased that the government has generally recognised that, and the focus on the Arctic will continue over many years. And I assure the government and all those people that gave us evidence, many of whom are here, that we will continue our interest in this region of the world, and whatever those changes are, then we will prod, as I'm sure will not be necessary in the future, the UK to make sure it plays its full part.